One of the taboos that began to be broken after the Second World War was that surrounding disability and disease. The least said about any problem, the better. People had a horror of being the centre of attention. But this martyrdom could be carried too far when it denied the sufferer the chance of ameliorating their condition, because to do otherwise might cause discomfort to others. Disability was treated in the same way as serious disease. Not only was the vocabulary that described it harsh, cripple was not deemed a term of abuse, but so too were the attitudes of many people towards it. The notion that a disabled person could have a perfectly fulfilling life was, in the early 1950s, radical. The patronising does-he-take-sugar mentality of killing with kindness prevailed widely. It would take a determined campaign by the disabled and their advocates before those with disability were allowed out of their metaphorical prisons. The eventual breaking of this taboo was led by a coalition of pressure groups that lobbied for the disabled to have the same consideration and opportunities as anyone else. This enlightened mood was also led by a film of 1952, Ealing Studios' Mandy, directed by Alexandra McKendrick. It's the story of a girl, Mandy Garland, born into an apparently well-to-do family in a London of bomb sites and cavernous houses in poor repair. Her parents realise when she's a toddler that she can hear nothing. She's diagnosed with a congenital hearing defect. Her auditory nerve has failed to develop. The Garlands follow their instincts, instincts dictated by the society in which they live, and seek to smother her in love and shield her, as far as they can, from the world. By imprisoning the child in her silent cell, they're doing the worst possible thing for her. When, at the age of 7, she's confronted by the normal, harmless behaviour of other children on a walk in the park with her parents, she can't relate to it. A small boy takes a toy from her, but agrees to return it, provided Mandy will say, "Please." But because Mandy can only see and not hear him, and has never learned to speak because of her deafness, she has no conception of what the boy's doing, other than that he's not letting her have her toy back. She follows her basic instinct and physically attacks him. The children's parents quickly separate them, but the admonishment of the Garlands by the boy's mother forces them to consider the consequences of Mandy's estrangement from the real world. "She's insane," the boy's mother yells. "She's not fit to be with other children." Mandy's mother, played sensitively by Phyllis Calvert, sees the rod they've made for their and their girl's back by failing to find a bridge between her and the rest of the world. The incident in the park provokes Christine Garland to think more widely. And for a time, her husband, played by Terence Morgan, joins with her in the search for something better. We then see another element of disability in the mid-20th century, the grim, forbidding Victorian institutions to which disabled children were consigned for any education deemed possible. Garland visits one that he finds, quite understandably, shocking, and refuses to consign Mandy to it. His wife refuses to be put off so easily, and through her best friend, who lives in Manchester, is put in touch with a school for deaf children that has the Victorian infrastructure, but, within it, highly enlightened and progressive teaching. Having seen it in operation for the remainder of the film, one's left to wonder how any other method could possibly have engaged children with such a profound disability to overcome. Christine Garland, too, was sceptical. Yet two things open her eyes after 7 years of mothering a girl who can't speak or communicate because, as Christine has seen it, she's deaf. She sees an equally deaf boy speaking to a teacher, and in a touching moment of brilliant direction by McKendrick, the boy slips his hand into Christine's, showing a social connection Mandy wouldn't know how to make. Then, in a conversation with the elderly doctor, who has had a lifetime's involvement with the school, Christine realises that, when the doctor turns away from her, she can't hear what's being said. She, too, is completely deaf and lip reads. "Yes," the doctor says, I'm one of them. Being profoundly deaf has not prevented her joining a profession and making a massive contribution to society. Christine realizes that all that stands between Mandy and a fulfilling life is prejudice and a suitable education, which the school can provide. This, though, is where on several fronts conflict comes into the film. The catalyst for it all is Dick Searle, played by Jack Hawkins, the headmaster of the school. Searle's methods, so revelatory to Mrs. Garland, are anathema to her husband, who doesn't want his daughter taken from him. Searle's attitudes, he's obsessed with doing his best for the children under his care and couldn't really care very much for anything else, upset the pompous, self-righteous Ackland, the solicitor for the charity that runs the school. Ackland, brilliantly played by the much underrated Edward Chapman, whose career deserved much better than to play Mr. Grimsdale in too many Norman Wisdom films, embodies the Victorian ethos that Searle's methods are determined to replace. He wears a wing collar. He worries about the state of repair the school is in and speaks of how ashamed he was when the mayor came to pay it a visit. He finds the children tiresome. And since no representation of blinkered Victorianism can be complete without a lavish dose of hypocrisy, he's also having an affair with a much younger, rather feline secretary. Angry with the way that Searle answers him back, he puts a private detective on him to try to prove he's having an affair with Mrs. Garland. We see charity as having a dark side, a vehicle for those who would self-aggrandise and use good works to conceal deficiencies of character. This film, from the early days of the welfare state, may be making a wider political point about who are the best custodians of the interests of the vulnerable. Garland's problem is that he's been spoilt by his mother, to whom he seems abnormally close for a married man. He spoils, to the point of emotional and intellectual suffocation, his daughter in just the same way. His wife, who's much more of a citizen of the world, wants both him and their daughter to break out of the prison. The Garlands argue about it, and Mrs. Garland touches the rawest possible nerve when she tells her husband, in frustration at his refusal to see the need for Mandy's wider education, "You're ashamed of Mandy. You just want to keep her out of sight." The thing about taboos is one's not supposed to refer to them directly, not least, one must suppose, because they're so blindingly obvious, that it's otiose to mention them. Confronted with this one, that the disabled are there not to be seen or heard, but just pitied, Garland hits his wife. "It was that that made up my mind," she says with distressing understatement in a narrative passage. She takes Mandy up to Manchester and enrolls her in Searle's school. Two other considerations make this one of the truly great British films. First, it has a documentary aspect. It was shot at, and with the cooperation of, the Royal Residential Schools for the Deaf in Manchester, with numerous deaf children playing Mandy's schoolfellows. This makes it both exceptionally realistic and exceptionally touching. There's none of the cloying sentimentality that would have been so easy to graft onto this film, and which would have harmed it irreparably, wrecking its value as a social problem film, and also diluting its effect as a campaigning document for better recognition of the worth of disabled people. Second, there's a stunning performance by the actress playing Mandy. Mandy Miller's acuity in playing her role has to be seen to be believed. Oscars have been won for less. It's not plain sailing. She hates being in the boarding school, so close has she been to her mother. Searle admits he's failed with her, and it seems as though she must leave, and Christine must admit defeat to her self-righteous husband. However, she chooses instead to rent rooms nearby, so Mandy can be a day girl. At that point, the devotion and brilliance of her teachers can be allowed to guide her towards some sort of development. The case for their specialist skills is made more than amply as, largely by trial and error, but with the teacher's unfailing patience, Mandy at last learns how to make sounds, to put them together in basic but coherent words, and to lip-read as well. Searle demonstrates his own devotion by giving Mandy extra coaching in the evenings. His marriage has broken up. The post-war divorce boom was at its height, and he has nothing else to do in the evenings. Besides, as he admits, Christine is rather soignée, and he's falling for her. She, though, wishes to remain married to her husband, despite the fact he's abused her. That aspect of their relationship shows another great gulf between the early 1950s and now. Garland doesn't want to become another statistic in the divorce boom either, but he does want to stop Christine having sole custody of Mandy and taking her against his and, more to the point, his own mother's wishes to Manchester. His solicitors, whom he consults on the matter, are sorry to hear he has assaulted his wife, but not for reasons of moral indignation. "We know they often ask for it," one of them says, "but the court takes a dim view." Equally depressing is the way Christine writes to her husband from Manchester, apologising for having said things that made him hit her. One senses that as soon as the case has been made for the emancipation of the disabled, a film was required to make the case for the emancipation of women, from the poisonous notion that if their husband smacked them, they'd almost certainly jolly well ask for it. Garland then becomes the weapon in Ackland's vendetta against Searle, being tipped off that Searle had been spotted spending his evening with Christine at her lodgings. Garland rushes to Manchester to seek the truth, an entirely self-serving and inaccurate version of which is given to him by the revolting Ackland, whose confidential secretary and mistress has just asked him whether she has to be confidential off-duty as well as on. Making the mistake of believing him, nothing improper has happened between Searle and Christine, Garland decides to take Mandy back to London, much against her best interests. Having seen how warmly Mandy reacts to Searle, Garland reacts like the selfish, mean-minded, jealous little boy his mother has always encouraged him to be. It's only when she gets back to London, and Garland's disengaged and distant father hears Mandy make a sound for the first time, that he orders his son to let her go back to Manchester. We don't see Mandy develop dramatically. We suspect life's always going to be a struggle for her. But by the end of the film, she's learned how to make friends and relate to other children, whose sounds made to her she can lip-read. She can say, "Mummy." She can find happiness in others. She can play with other children who don't share her disability. As Christine says, it's like seeing the door of a cage beginning to open. It was the intense realism of this film that made it so valuable as part of the campaign run by Ealing Studios through various films throughout its history to make Britain a more civilised and less narrow-minded place. If Mandy has a fault, it's that those on the other side of the divide from enlightenment are too cardboard cut-out in their unpleasantness, while the forces of light are just a bit too saintly. The film's realism also makes it a valuable historical document. It shows with piercing clarity a society that suddenly realised that treating disabled people as embarrassments or pariahs is inhumane and intensely destructive. It seems almost to capture the exact revelatory moment when the more thoughtful realised that people with disabilities had potential and had a fundamental right to develop it. Mandy caused an immense stir on its release and significantly changed the public's perception of deafness. Whereas some films contribute to a drip-drip effect on social change, this had an effect that was altogether more immediate, more radical, and more profound. It's also, and not least for that reason, one of the films of which the British cinema has the most right to be proud.